Chapter 9. Dirk pulled himself through the hatch and into the pitch-black darkness of the torpedo room, save for the penetrating beam of light. As his eyes adjusted to the blackness, the flashing green light became clearer. It appeared to be a pair of tiny lights, situated at eye level and fixed at the far side of the room. Dirk turned his own light back on and surveyed the room. He was in the upper torpedo room, one of two torpedo bays the I-403 had stacked vertically at the bow of the sub. Near the forward bulkhead, he could see the round chamber hatches for the four 21-inch diameter torpedo tubes. Lying in racks on either side of the room were six of the huge Type 95 torpedoes, large and deadly fish that were both more reliable and more explosive than the American counterpart during the war. Jumbled on the floor, Dirk shined his light on two additional torpedoes that had been jarred out of their racks when the submarine had slammed into the bottom. One torpedo lay flat on the floor, its nose angled slightly off bow from where it had rolled after hitting the deck. The second torpedo was propped on some debris near its tip, pointing its nose lazily upward. It was just above this second torpedo where the eerie green light flashed on and off. Dirk floated over to the pulsating light, putting his face mask up close to the mystery beam. It was nothing more than a small, stick-on digital clock wedged at the end of the torpedo rack. Fluorescent block green numbers flashed a row of zeros, indicating an elapsed time that had run out more than 24 hours before. Days, weeks, or months before, it would be impossible to tell. But it certainly could not have been placed there 60 years earlier. Dirk plucked the plastic clock and stuffed it in a pocket of his BC, then peered upward. His expended air bubbles were not gathering at the ceiling as expected, but were trailing upward and through a shaft of pale light. He kicked up with his fins and found that a large hatch to the open deck had been wedged open several feet, easily allowing a diver access to and from the torpedo bay. A crackly voice suddenly burst through his earpiece. "Dirk, where are you?" "It's time to go upstairs," Dahlgren's voice barked. "I'm in the forward torpedo room. Come meet me on the bow. I need another minute." Dirk looked at his watch, noting that their 8 minutes of bottom time had expired, then swam back down to the torpedo rack. Two wooden crates were crushed beneath one of the fallen torpedoes, split open like a pair of suitcases. Constructed of hardwood mahogany, the crates had amazingly survived the ravages of salt water and microorganisms and were in a minimal state of decay. He curiously noted that no silt covered the broken crates, unlike every other object he had seen on the submarine. Someone had recently fanned away the sediment to reveal the crate's contents. Dirk swam over to the closest crate and looked inside. Like a half carton of eggs, six silver aerial bombs were lined up in a custom-fitted casemate. Each bomb was nearly 3 feet long and sausage-shaped, with a fin-winged tail. Half of the bombs were still wedged under the torpedo, but all six had been broken up by the torpedo's fall. Oddly, they appeared to be cracked rather than simply crushed. Running his hand over an undamaged section of one of the bombs, he was surprised to feel the surface had a glassy smoothness to the touch. Kicking his fins gently, Dirk then glided over to the other crate and found a similar scene. All of the bomb canisters had been crushed by the falling torpedo in the second crate as well. Only this time, he counted five bombs, not six. One of the casings was empty. Dirk shined his light around and surveyed the area. The deck was clear in all directions, and no fragments were evident in the empty slot. One of the bombs was missing. "Elevator, going up," Dahlgren's voice suddenly crackled. "Hold the door, I'll be right there," Dirk replied, glancing at his watch to see that they had overrun their bottom time by almost 5 minutes. Examining the smashed crates a last time, he tugged on one of the less mangled bombs. The ordnance slipped out of its case, but fell apart into three separate pieces in Dirk's hands. As best he could, he gently placed the three pieces into a large mesh dive bag, then holding tight, he kicked towards the open hatch above. Pulling the bag through the hatch after him, Dirk found Dahlgren hovering above the sub's bow a few yards in front of him. Joining his dive partner, the two wasted no time in kicking towards their decompression stop. Tracking their depth as they rose, Dirk flared his body out like a skydiver at 40 feet to slow his ascent and purged a shot of air out of his BC. Dahlgren followed suit, and the two men stabilized themselves at a depth of 20 feet to help rid their bodies of elevated levels of nitrogen in their blood.
That extra 5 minutes on the bottom cost us another 13 of decompression time.
I'll be sucking my tank dry before 38 minutes rolls around, Dahlgren said, eyeing his depleted air gauge. Before Dirk could answer, they heard a muffled metallic clang in the distance.
Never fear, Leo is here, Dirk remarked, pointing at an object 40 feet to their side.
A pair of silver scuba tanks with attached regulators dangled at the 20-foot mark, tied to a rope which ascended to the surface. At the other end of the rope, Delgado stood munching a banana on the back deck of the Grunion, tracking the men's air bubbles and making sure they didn't stray too far from the boat. After hovering for a 15-minute decompression stop at 20 feet, the men grabbed the regulators affixed to the dangling tanks and floated up to 10 feet for another 25-minute wait. When Dirk and Dahlgren finally surfaced and climbed aboard the boat, Delgado acknowledged the men with just a wave as he turned the boat for landfall. As the boat motored into the calmer waters of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Dirk unwrapped the bomb canister fragments and laid them on the deck.
No sign of one of these on the aircraft or in the hangar? Dirk asked.
Definitely not.
There was plenty of parts, tools, and other debris in the hangar, but nothing that looked like that, Dahlgren replied, eyeing the pieces.
Why would a canister crack open like that?
Because it's made of porcelain, Dirk replied, holding a shard up for Dahlgren's closer inspection. Dahlgren ran a finger over the surface, then shook his head.
A porcelain bomb.
Very handy for attacking tea parties, I presume.
Must have something to do with the payload.
Dirk rearranged the fragments until they fit roughly together, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. The payload armament had long since washed away in the sea, but several compartmentalized sections formed in the interior were clearly evident.
Looks like different combustibles were to react together when detonated.
An incendiary bomb? Dahlgren asked.
Perhaps, Dirk replied quietly.
He then reached into the side pocket of his BC and pulled out the digital timer.
Someone went to a fair amount of trouble to retrieve one of these bombs, he said, tossing the timer over to Dahlgren.
Dahlgren studied the device, turning it over in his hands.
Maybe it was the original owner, he finally said with seriousness.
Raising his arm with the timer in his palm, he showed Dirk the backside of the clock. In raised lettering on the plastic case was an indecipherable line of Asian script.